This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to episode 21 of Herding Code. This week we're talking about real-world .NET development. We're going to talk about the difference between the way you hear you should do things and the way you actually do them on your 9-to-5 job. One thing that we talked about was, what are kind of the non-negotiables? What are the things that you, no matter what, would never give up when you're developing code? Like, for instance, I think with, even if I'm writing a tiny console app, I'm always going to include source control. Like, I think source control is something where you're going to need it pretty much no matter what. Are there some other things that you guys just could not work without or would not work without?
Yeah, I think that, and maybe this is kind of obvious, but to a certain extent, if you're going to be using a statically typed language, then, you know, you shouldn't declare everything as object and then do lots of casting. I don't know, maybe that's too obvious. Maybe no one really does that in the real world, but I've seen some code where, you know, it's always something as object or taking an object in the parameter and then, you know, trying to cast it to several things when really what you wanted was a polymorphic method. I've seen code like that out in the real world. But that, I don't know, that's kind of bad code, period, I think.
It is bad code, but I've seen it in plenty of times, so it's probably worth saying.
There's a lot of places too, especially when you're working with like VBA or Office or, you know, like any kind of COM related code where you're just stuck with some of that stuff. Interop is always just, it's there's no clean way to do it. I don't know what the metaphor is for that one, but you're not going to end up, you'll get it done, but it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah. And back in the VB6 days, and everything was variant all the time, and you'd get these really screwed up situations where you'd have a variant array of strings or a string array of variants, and everything would just blow up when you try to access it. So it always seems to me that, you know, if you're going to work within a statically typed system, then you should statically type things.
I think one thing that points out, you know, is the whole idea of a framework. Like, how much do you think your framework through as you start developing? I usually kind of err on the side of let the system define itself, and I just kind of, I don't just say, oh, all right, roll up my sleeves and start coding, but I am pretty quick to try and get something out there and then improve on it, where as opposed to kind of thinking through a system and building out a framework and stuff.
You just let it organically grow out of what you're doing versus designing it ahead of time, saying, oh, well, I'm obviously going to need these kinds of methods and objects because...
Right. Well, you know, I think that kind of points out a big, like, kind of disconnect on that a lot of us run into is the kind of work that I'm doing. And I think I'm in a weird place because I'm generally working with, like, alpha and beta releases of Microsoft products, and I'm doing things that are, they're not disposable, but they're not built to be durable for 5 years. And they're not, you know, so, like, last year I built something to run on Silverlight 1.0, and I wrote a ton of JavaScript and I got this thing working, and like, you'd be crazy to use the code I wrote because that's, you know, like Silverlight 2.0 is shipping before the end of this year, and it's, you know, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. And right now I'm working on code for a conference, and we're going to leverage this code that I've written, but this conference is going to end, you know? And so there's different levels to this. I've also worked in financial applications where some of the code was probably older than me and, you know, is going to outlast me. But I do think that
that brings up an interesting point. You know, so you do work a lot with, you know, beta and alpha stuff from Microsoft, and ultimately your code gets held up as, you know, an example of how to do things. And so it's almost like you're putting out demo code, and, you know, maybe it needs to be a little bit better, you know, quality or better thought out if it's going to be put up there as an example. And, you know, in terms of the conference site, you know, maybe they're going to have, you know, another conference later on, and maybe you can reuse some of the code. And maybe it's worthwhile to develop kind of a conference site framework or let it grow out of there.
I think, was it my imagination, or did Scott just call you out for your lousy code that you're putting out there? That was cold, man. No.
Ouch. Yeah, let me defend myself, because I wasn't saying you should just whip out crap code. I mean, with the conference site, we didn't know it ahead of time, but we've ended up repurposing it twice now, and it's worked really well for that. It's not because we use a conference factory and you know, put a lot of heavy design into it. I think it actually works well for this because we kept it incredibly simple. We made it as absolutely simple as we could, and so that lowers the barrier to reuse, I think. Also, we put a lot of effort into clean semantic HTML and CSS, and that's allowed us to be able to change anything on the user interface side very smoothly. And with regard to the, you know, work with demo software, some of it, the code never sees the light of day. It's a demonstration. But whenever the code is released, like when I had code going out on CodePlex, you can bet I work nights and weekends to clean up my code, make it look as nice as I could, because I knew people would be looking at it. But a lot of that code that I wrote, I mean, this was Silverlight 1.0, so that code had a very definite lifespan, and it wouldn't have made any sense to build that system out as if it was designed to last for 20 years, because it's very clearly not. So I guess the point is you make trade-offs when you're developing software, and if I'm building a proof of concept or a demonstration application, then time to market is a huge factor. And in many of those cases, nobody's ever going to see my code. So code quality and methodology is only important if it helps me deliver quality software in time. And if I'm building something like a conference website, then the goal has to be that I keep the client happy with the quality of the deliverable from the end user point of view, and that the code methodologies help the team work better and get their job done and on time and be able to handle change. So while I want to keep informed with what everyone's writing about how you should build quality software and how good software is built, I've got to ignore a lot of that advice depending on which project I'm working on, because I can't please everyone with every single line of code that I write.
Well, and I wasn't pointing out any specific thing that you've done, John, because I haven't.
Ouch!
I haven't,
code review.
I wasn't saying John obviously doesn't give a crap about what he throws up there on the inner tubes, but you know, I wouldn't say that. But it's just, you know, I think about that sometimes when I'm designing code or when I'm writing code on a solitary project. I definitely write differently than when I'm writing it with a group. So, like when I'm writing on a solitary project, I'll follow my own coding conventions, my own naming conventions, and whatnot, and my own indentions, and I put the braces on the correct line and so forth. And I'm not going to say which that is, because I don't want to start that religious war. But then when I'm working with a team, I tend to, you know, kind of do what the majority of the team is doing so that my code looks like theirs, instead of, you know, being able to say, oh, well, obviously Scott wrote this part because the braces are all screwed up and everything's on one big, huge line in a ternary.
Right. That's always been something that I would, you know, when I got the opportunity to be a team lead, I was always happy when a team member wrote code that I couldn't tell who wrote it. You know, it's just you write chameleon code that just fits in, and when you're doing your own thing, you make your own decisions, but when you're working on a project, you know, if everyone's doing it this way, it's best to fit in that way. I don't know. Kevin?
Yeah, obviously there are circumstances where, you know, there is such a thing as throwaway code, and it's not worth investing a huge amount of time in, but I'm often surprised at how often things that people think are going to be throwaway code end up living for an astoundingly long time. I won't say I don't believe in throwaway code. I always think twice before I assume that the code that I'm writing is going to be sort of a one-off thing. It may live on in its current form. It may end up getting copy-pasted into some other project. I'm perpetually surprised at how long the stuff lives, often much, much longer than I would ever expect.
My theory is that every company, no matter how big or small, somewhere on someone's desktop, there's an Access database that is vitally important to the operation of the entire company. And so far, everywhere I've worked, that's been true. There's either an Excel spreadsheet or an Access database with tons of custom macros in it that runs the joint. And it was always started like Kevin said, a throwaway code just for now until we get to buy the big, huge, you know, EPS or whatever they're looking to do. And it always ends up surviving, you know, every programmer who has ever worked on it.
You know, I think that that's something that, as you know, all of us, as we've gotten more experience and been on projects over the years, you kind of get this ability to smell something, you know, like you can say this thing here is going to live on and I need to worry about this. And then there's other, well, cynicism, yes, but there's other things, you know, where there's huge corporate initiatives to do this and that, and you go along with it, but in the back of your mind, you're like, this is absolutely never going to work. Like, it's just not going to happen. And so, you know, there's different areas where you just kind of, after a while, you get like a sense of what you're going to need to really think through and put your time into, because it matters, versus things that are going to probably be throwaway code. So I was thinking about that this past weekend, because I was writing a utility that I had always wanted to write, and I didn't write any tests with it. I just started banging out code and making it work. And a lot of it was because I was writing glue code that was just hooking things together. But I realized that, you know, a lot, like some people, there's a difference between writing tests because they're good for the health of the code versus tests as a design, you know, test first development. And I'm just wondering what you guys, if you're writing, you know, a console application on a Friday night, are you going to start with some unit tests, or are you just going to start banging it out? Come on, fess up, I did.
I will admit that if I'm doing like sort of exploratory, spiky kind of coding, I'll, you know, sometimes do that without tests, although sometimes I use tests to actually do that sort of exploratory coding. But I get this funny feeling when I write code where at some point I get, this is probably just because I'm not a very good programmer, at some point I get to a point where I start to get really uncomfortable if I don't have tests. Like, I feel myself like sort of get twitchy that, you know, can I really change this code without breaking what I've already done? And I really have come to rely on unit tests as my security blanket for code of even moderate or low complexity. I mean, that's just me, but it really has become sort of imbued into the way I think about writing code.
Scott?
Way back in the olden days, we used to write, we didn't write unit tests necessarily, but we wrote test harnesses that we could call up from batch files. And I've kind of fallen out of that habit. You know, I still have some kind of test in there, but I found that I can't always distinguish between a unit test and integration test and, you know, any other kind of test that you can think of. And when you start to work with a team, that distinction becomes even more important, because, you know, you start to write tests that you think are unit tests, and then someone is, you know, that's not really testing, you know, what that, you know, it's not testing that the data is getting inserted into the database. And you say, well, that's not really a unit test. That's an integration test. And, oh, but we need to test that. And not right now. And, you know, how do we write that? Because the code is so, you know, we can't mock out the data insert. And, you know, that becomes this big mess. And consequently, no tests get written. And, I mean, it's easier when you're starting from the greenfield project, the mythical greenfield project, as I call it, and you get to, you know, say file new project, new test, you know, new everything, and you get to, you know, start from the beginning. But for the most part, you're working with, you know, messy code that, you know, isn't properly architected, and you can insert the quotes around the properly part. And, you know, so there's not always separation of concerns. There's not always single responsibility and contained within your classes or methods. And so you're kind of stuck. You can either write a test that mocks out the entire world and, you know, everything from HTTP requests down to, you know, whatever you need to do, the database layer, and try to do that. Or you can write these very messy looking, you know, tests that you don't really have confidence in. Because they make so many assumptions about the underlying objects. And I haven't found a good solution for that yet. I figure something is better than nothing. And even if, you know, I don't necessarily agree with my something, at least it's not nothing.
So that made me think of several things, Scott, that you were saying. That there's the... Sometimes the requirement to write pure code means that you write a lot of code. And so in a case like, I know, I mean, before the .NET community, at least, was talking a lot about test-driven development, people were talking about providers. And I remember that everybody, whenever they wrote a framework, they wrote providers and they used a provider model. And then in the majority of cases, there was only ever one provider ever written using that provider model. And you know, I mean, obviously there's less of a, or there's a better trade-off with test-driven development because you really are writing tests and using those tests, but it does at a point seem like, you know, you're writing, you know, mocks and stubs and tests and all this stuff in order to accomplish, you know, what? So, like, yes, your code is more testable and higher quality, providing you wrote good tests, which who knows if you did. So I just kind of wonder about that, you know, like if you're given a week or a month or whatever to write an application, how much of that is, where the trade-off is, where it starts being worthwhile. Well, so recently, Roy Oshirov wrote an interesting series of posts where he was talking from a pragmatic point of view about test-driven development. And he started with one that a post called Goodbye Mocks, Farewell Stubs. And in that he was talking about, you know, why aren't people writing unit tests? And, you know, some of it was on the learning curves and the crazy, you know, some of the naming conventions, and a lot of it, he wrote two more follow-up posts, and he was talking about, you know, that people get so fixated on the religious side of it, where it's like, you either do this the pure way, or, you know, we have nothing to do with you. And that kind of resonated with me. I liked what he was saying, where it was like, you know, 20% code coverage is better than no code coverage, and get people into writing code the right way, and don't lower the barriers to entry. I wondered what you guys thought about that.
I read at least one of the posts, and you know, I think there's some, you know, there's some validity to that. I mean, there's a lot of sort of terminology that's associated with test doubles and mocks and stubs, and you know, is that all too confusing for you know, people who are just trying to get into this thing? But I don't know. To me, the hard part of unit testing, test driving is just knowing how to write a good test, like what constitutes a good test versus what constitutes a bad test. And it's one of those things that's really hard to explain. It's really hard to just list in bullet points. It's really easy to kind of go down a path where you write tests that just sort of mirror the implementation of the class that you're writing, and therefore become very fragile and very coupled to the object that you're testing. To me, that's like the crux of the learning curve with test-driven development. Not so much the terminology stuff. I mean, a little bit, but I didn't find that to be a huge issue. But, you know, sort of knowing how to write tests that are not brittle and don't make the code brittle and therefore don't make the code harder to maintain is the hard part to me. And that's one of those things that's really tough because it comes with experience and it comes with writing tests different kinds of ways and seeing what works and what doesn't. And, you know, I don't know if there's a magic, like, silver bullet to teaching people how to do that effectively.
Scott, any thoughts on Roy's posts?
They're rather involved. There's like three of them I'm posting in there. There's the Goodbye Mox Farewell Stubs. There's unit testing decoupled from design equals adoption, which sounds interesting. I think that's what Kevin was kind of touching on there. And unit testing decoupled from TDD as well equals adoption, where he kind of makes the assertion TDD is not unit testing. And yeah, I can see that. A lot of people do equate TDD with unit testing, and really TDD is more about the design rather than just having unit tests in there. It's the idea that by writing these tests, like Kevin was saying earlier, you get confidence in the ability to change the code, and you have a better understanding of how the code works. And I found that when I start to write tests for existing code and I refactor them to make them more testable, that I end up generally with better designed code. But I also think that TDD is kind of a ritual, and that if you do it long enough, if you perform the ritual long enough, you do, you know, TDD long enough, that you eventually get to the point where you can just, the design just comes, flows organically out of you instead of being driven by the tests. And so you end up writing code that is less decoupled or less coupled and you know, and follows things like single responsibility principle, SRP. Yeah, so I guess there's my flaming incentive. TDD equals ritual.
Well, there's an interesting post my friend Ben Griswold wrote a little while ago about when I worked at this financial company, and we all kind of knew we should be. I mean, at a financial company, you really should be writing tests. I mean, and I can make excuses for myself when I'm writing mostly front end code, and I'm primarily focused a lot of the time on the visual elements, and it's on changing APIs for which there's no way to test and that kind of thing. But when we were working on financial processing code and frameworks that handled this, like, yeah, it should be using unit tests. And we had a project where, you know, that was kind of the part of the, like, right at the beginning, we're like, we're going to do this the right way. This is going to be a message processing system. It will use unit tests. And I left as that project was in process. But what I heard afterwards was it was a remarkable success. And that project had much lower defect rates. And things went really well. But then when you actually talk to one of the developers, it was like, yeah, not really. What we did was anytime there was a bug, we never logged a bug against that project. We always logged it against, you know, whoever was integrating with it and that kind of thing. And so it was something where I think that, you know, possibly it was that everyone expected a quick win with test-driven development when really it takes some time to see a payoff to it. But it was like, hey, let's do this one project, and then, you know, people kind of made it sound like it was a success when really it was probably a foot in, you know, dipping a foot in the pool. Scott?
there was a post, and I forget who posted, if it was Kevin or someone else today, about how to fail with Agile. And it was a PDF article that was written, and they went through and... Was it Matt Popwasaki? Of course. And it was an interesting read talking about how, you know, the people will either undermine the Agile process and test-driven development by doing things like you'd mentioned, not filing bugs against the product or, you know, not reporting them, you know, just trying to fix them and patch them. Or, you know, just not following the principles. I see that a lot. I see where, you know, people try to adopt these methodologies or try to adopt good design, but then they end up subverting it either in the name of, you know, time constraints, you know, unrealistic time constraints from the environment or management / marketing / whoever, or just because, you know, at some point good design is hard to do, and, you know, you can fall back to the way that you've always done things and just start, you know, churning out code, which is, you know, makes you feel better. But it's a dangerous state to kind of be in when you're, you know, just churning out the code and not trying to follow the best practices or for whatever you've decided for yourself are best practices.
Right. I've definitely worked on projects where, you know, we said, okay, we're doing Agile and this is how it works and we're doing, you know, rapid releases and all this kind of thing, and we explain it and you can tell, like, the client picks it up and goes, oh, yeah, we know this. Yeah, cowboy coding, right? You know, we'll just kind of go for it. And it's like, no, we actually do have, like, a method to this. We're following this thing. But I really have seen that when you get into this process where you're, you know, you expect that you're going to be doing Agile development, and they, like, pick up on the you know, oh, we don't have to write detailed specification and we can change, you know, we can change our minds. Oh yeah, okay, cowboy coding. We know this stuff.
They pick up on the rapid deployment part, but not the not the
right,
small feature set.
Yeah, exactly. Kevin?
Just going back to something, sort of touching on something Scott said earlier, which is that, you know, with test-driven development and unit testing, sometimes it can be the fact that doing it wrong is worse than not doing it. You know, sometimes if you write a ton of, like, really fragile tests, then, you know, every time you make any trivial change to the code, you break 1,000 tests, and people can get really sort of disenchanted with the whole approach. So I guess my point is that, you know, there is a big difference between, you know, doing it right and doing it wrong. It's not always that just doing something is better than doing nothing. I've also learned, you know, in my experience that things like test-driven development and unit testing are not things that can be dictated to a team. They're something that the team really have to, like, buy into in a big way. And if they don't, then people will always find a way to circumvent the system and do as little as possible, and in the end you end up in that situation again where you have these sort of half-assed unit tests which hurt more than they help. The unit test handcuffs, as some people call them.
As I read blogs, I continually am frustrated by people making blanket statements. All blanket statements are wrong. Because, I mean, people always go off and say, you know, like, this is the way you should develop, or only bad coders do this, or only good coders do that. And I think that for all of us, it's like, after a while, you've worked on different projects where, in some cases, you need an upfront specification for certain things. Like, there's just no two ways about it. And then there's other projects where the right thing to do is get something in front of the client immediately. And, you know, in some projects, you're writing a framework that's going to last for a while and needs to be testable because it's for a variety of reasons. And then there's other cases where
you're writing code that's exploratory. But exploratory doesn't mean toy code. It means very difficult, research-intensive code. You know, I mean, there's significant work involved, but it's exploratory code. So I don't know for myself if I'm always off on the sidelines, you know, in La La Land, and everybody else is talking about the way things should be. But I really am frequently reading people talking about the way you should always develop and being like, well, not really, because if you're doing this, that doesn't apply. So I don't know. I mean, people complain about, you know, you shouldn't have weasel words in your post, but or people shouldn't use weasel words when they're making when they're laying down the law. But I'd like to see more of them. I'd like people to talk about their context a little bit more and say, when you're doing this, this is the right way to do things.
More weasel words.
More weasel words.
Woohoo!
I've been planning to write a post called "In Praise of Weasel Words."
So let's move on from test-driven development to talking about drag-and-drop controls, or system.draggy-droppy, as Scott Belwer calls them. On Alt.net podcast episode 1, David Larrabee was talking about how a significant percentage of applications are forms over data, and that's just how it is, and that's partly just a business reality. In order to get scale and working with the development workforce that's available, you're going to be building a lot of applications as forms over data. You're not going to be able to make every single application built the way you would like to build it. And, you know, he went on to say that we need to demand more testable, and we need that our controls help us, our controls and our development environments help us build applications the way they should be built. But, you know, in the meantime, we've got applications to be built. We've got forms over data applications. And to me, that means we're using a lot of drag and drop controls still. I just wonder what you guys think about that.
You have to balance the convenience of the drag and drop and data bind to, you know, SQL data source versus, you know, the quick throwaway app that turns into the business linchpin. I mean, we just earlier talked about how, you know, this code that you think is going to be throwaway ends up, you know, outliving you and being modified and maintained by people other than you for years to come. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, most of the internal, let's say internal, you know, kind of corporate internet applications are all, you know, just basically data pumps. Put data in, get data out. You know, whatever gets it to the table the fastest. And you don't have to worry about scaling because there's only 10 people in the group that are ever going to use it. And
well, and to just interject, you know, you don't have to worry about scaling development experience either, because for a lot of people writing intranet applications, you don't have the budget or the skill set to have everybody, you know, writing optimal, you know, Uber code or code. You just don't have the skills available. Like I don't know if that's been your guys' experience, but I've definitely worked on smaller teams where you've got people that really are just kind of learning their way around Visual Studio, and you need them to start. You've got 3 weeks for them to have an application done.
Well, there have definitely been times when I've used the dataset designer to, you know, design out you know, statically typed datasets, because the person that I'm working with is, you know, not going to be able to come up to speed on something like an ORM very quickly, and I don't have the time to sit down and train them because of, you know, whatever's going on. And so, yeah, you do end up, you know, dragging and dropping that. But I've also gone through and made sure that as I'm doing these statically typed data sets, that I'm, you know, I'm adding my methods to them where possible. And, you know, in the rest of the app, I'm kind of, you know, I'm doing more DI, and I'm just saying, look, you know, when they see it, you know, they'll understand what's going on and how to do it, or they won't have to, you know, they won't have to write any more of that. They'll just have to maintain it. But yeah, you do end up with, you know, this conundrum of, you know, you want to get something quick and out the door and it's, you know, a one-off, but at the same time, you know, these things often end up being persistent in the enterprise. And so I always wonder if maybe the key is to make the quality or the, not necessarily the quality, but to make the drag and drop a better experience. And I think that if you were to, you know, modify the visual designer, and we're primarily talking about Visual Studio here, because I don't know of too many other applications or other programming languages that have, you know, a visual designer that's quite like this. I haven't looked at IntelliJ for a long time, though, but Object Builder is, or not Object, but Interface Builder is completely different on OS X than Visual Studio. They enforce the MVC pattern by design there. So there is no drag and drop of controls that data bind into all this stuff in the background. You have to explicitly set these properties. But maybe the clue is to make that a better experience so that when you drag and drop code on there, you don't think, oh my God, you know, so I'm going to have all these things called button one and button two and the code behind the code gen is just going to be a mess. And, you know, I'm going to have to go in and modify it. And then if someone else code gens, you know, or drag some other control on there, it's going to screw that up. And we're going to have to go back and rewrite that. And you know, myself, I kind of want to move towards the Star Trek experience where I just walk up and say, computer, write me a program that will simulate the motion of the planets in the year 1839. I don't want to have to write a DI container for iPlanet.
In all fairness, I think I've seen a lot of improvement in the way that drag and drop controls have worked over the years, starting back with, I guess I work with Visual Basic 3 and just working through like the way that data binding, it's possible to using ASP.NET controls, using a list view and using link, forgetting for a minute the MVC approach, but just to write, you know, very clean code and on, you know, in the list view to write very to control my markup and output very clean HTML. But I guess to, you know, when I think about it, then I'm writing most of that. I'm not doing the drag and drop approach. I'm using controls that have a drag and drop interface, but I'm not leveraging that.
So I mean, I guess I have a slightly different perspective coming from the ISV world, where there is, you know, I'm not writing internal applications for the most part. I'm generally writing long-lived code, but you know, in that context, drag and drop is almost never a good solution. It just, it never ends up being sustainable, you know, maintainable in the long run. And you know, I do feel like in a lot of ways Microsoft targets their tools to the creation part of the project and not the maintenance part of the project. And I'm sure that's because that helps them sell their tools, but it kind of shortchanges the, you know, the developers who are stuck working with this stuff.
Well, I definitely agree, and but that does bring up a question I've had for a while, which is, you know, we all talk about the statistic that code spends 80% of its time in the maintenance phase, like 20% of the time and effort spent on code is in the development, and then after that it lives on and it's in this maintenance phase forever. But I believe that metric came out in the desktop development days, and I don't think it's been updated for the web. And I think that if my experience in development has been representative, I'd say that, I mean, the half-life of my code is tiny. Like, you know, even applications that I've written that have been well used, etc., if I average that out, I mean, a lot of code spends, some code never hits production, some code is in production for a couple of years at best. And so, you know, I do wonder about that if we're developing for, like, Kevin, obviously you're developing in your projects for things that last longer, but a lot of applications I've worked on over my development career have never been released or have been released and then are replaced a year later with marketing's new design and everything else is thrown out. And I just wonder, I don't know if we've kind of updated our rhetoric to match the reality of what's going on with this web deployment, you know, with this age where everything's deployed to the web.
Again, it's all about context. I mean, that's the context in which I work. People build these systems and they run literally for years. Some of our customers are still running, you know, 10-year-old versions of our software. And they work, and they don't want to touch them because they work. They're definitely not into, you know, turning stuff over every couple of years. This is mostly like line of business applications where companies run their entire business on these applications. It's falls squarely into the if it ain't broke, don't fix it category of software development. So in my world, you know, that is far more the norm than, you know, code that only lives a few months because it's some marketing website or because, you know, somebody gets a bee in their bonnet for some new technology and want to turn this stuff over. And I tend to feel like from a corporate development perspective, that's more common than the flip side of, you know, writing something that's only going to live for 6 months. I mean, people generally, the people that I interact with build systems that they use to run their company, and their company doesn't change every 6 months, which is a little different than maybe John's experience where you're writing lots of demo applications and, you know, cool experimental code.
I wonder how embedded software developers deal with this stuff. Because, you know, you're not gonna swap out a car chip, you know.
or a pacemaker, right? Yeah,
wonder if they're unit testing.
We're going to do a flash memory upgrade on your pacemaker.
Yeah, hold on. We have a service pack for your insulin pump.
You know,
Whoa, going a little fast there.
We've got
we'll
new
fix
patch.
That with a hot fix.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, yeah, over the years, I've worked on a variety of different systems. I've worked on desktop applications. I worked on a website that at one point had 20,000 separate ASP files. And we had to convert that. Over time, we converted it to run on a CMS and got it down to, you know, actually a few hundred files. But yeah, it was literally 20,000 files, ASP files. And so I have seen some different sides of this. And you know, at that time, I was wanting to work mostly in C# and spending a lot of time in trying to figure out how to upgrade this behemoth ASP application. I don't want to sound like I've only, you know, been playing with glittery shiny stuff for my entire career, but I think that there are some ways that, like, for instance, I think in that application that there was a fixation with staying with something stable and something that worked over moving to the new app, the new stuff, way too long. Like, that application should have been moved to C# and should have been moved to you know, more modern framework much earlier. I think a lot of people spend way too long postponing those improvements to their detriment. You know, you end up with something that's, you're trying to maintain this huge legacy application because you made it a huge legacy application instead of continually evolving it.
To a certain extent, I see what you're saying, that the if it ain't broke, don't fix it mentality can definitely, you know, bite you in the butt if you're missing chances for, you know, improvements in your process or your applications because, you're so afraid to touch things that you know, you're sort of frozen in time. I think we're bringing it back to sort of the test-driven development and, you know, having the confidence to change those things while, you know, not destabilizing a running system is a huge enabler for, you know, that sort of change. Not just from a technology perspective, but from a process perspective. Like, you know, we can significantly improve our effectiveness if we make so-and-so-and-so changes, and you're able to do that and not stuck because the developer who wrote that code 5 years ago has long since quit and nobody knows how it works.
Or in our case, actually had perished. There was a, in the courtyard at our financial institution, there was a bench, and the bench had this guy's name on it, and apparently he had written a lot of the authorization code and then had perished of a heart attack. And everyone afterwards was like, would kick the bench when they walked by it, because it was just, it was the kind of code that used, you had to add a column to a table every time you wanted to add a new user type, that kind of deal.
So we talked a little bit about, you know, test-driven development and some design stuff. We've also talked about the drag-and-drop development, and sort of on the extreme other end of the drag-and-drop development is what some people are sort of lumping into the alt.net moniker. And I'm curious what you guys think of that approach, that mindset, that methodology. Not really a methodology, but that belief system, I guess. You know, is that, do you guys see people, you know, aside from the alt.net mailing list, do you guys in your day-to-day work see a lot of people really digging into those philosophies and really, you know, buying into them? Or is that not filtered down into, you know, the quote-unquote real world?
So I'm in a weird case, because at Vertigo, I work with a lot of very talented developers, but our job is to dig into unreleased code and to figure out how to make it work. And often it's not testable, and even if you did figure out how to test it, 2 weeks later when the next rev comes out, all your tests would break because everything's changed. And not in a way that you'd be happy that you had unit tests, in a way that you'd be sorry that you wasted your time writing those unit tests. And so it's an edge case, you know. I don't know if this is a place where I don't know if I'm able to really answer this question. I know that, you know, if I look over my history of development, I think a lot of it comes down to the developers that I've worked with that are passionate about writing good, or passionate about writing software. And those places that I worked with developers that were passionate about their craft and that were writing framework code, then they were always into, you know, how can I test this? How can I? And at the time, you know, some of these alt.net qualities and things hadn't sprung up, but I mean, that's actually, you know, in a weird way, that's been something I've always been into as well. I mean, I spent the majority of my career writing, doing maintenance, you know, working on large systems that had evolved into crazy behemoths, and we were just trying to figure out what they were doing and why, and trying to get control of them. And so, I think I was one of the early people that linked to to David Larrabee's alt.net post. And I'm a supporter of what they're going for. I found it difficult to apply to my day-to-day work lately, as I've moved into roles that are more exploratory and less about writing long-lasting frameworks. So I don't know if that's really representative, though, or if that's a useful answer. Scott K.?
I think I'm starting to see more adoption at the places that I work at. Sometimes it's because I'm there evangelizing these techniques, and showing people how to use them. Or in other places, you know, I come in and I'm happy to find out that you know, when I mention these alt.net meetings or, you know, point them to an article, other people say, yeah, I read that. You know, I'm looking to do more of that here, you know. But it's hard to paint, you know, certain techniques as alt.net, just because, you know, so much of it goes down to the alt.net preaching, you know, solid techniques and good design, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to ascribe stuff that was written about, you know, 15 or 20 years ago to alt.net. You know, I see them quote, you know, Bob Martin and Martin Fowler, and, you know, those guys certainly were around before alt.net, and those, you know, independent of anything that maybe may or may not be wrong with Microsoft, I mean, these techniques have been around for a while, and I've always kind of noted with some amusement that, you know, patterns weren't important to Microsoft and Microsoft developers until the mainstream language that Microsoft developers were using could support it. You know, you couldn't really do, you know, any of the classic Gang of Four patterns in Visual Basic. And Visual Basic was the workhorse of business development for, you know, God knows how many years. And it wasn't until C# came out and you could do things with interfaces and have actual inheritance. And, you know, and then suddenly everyone was a pattern expert. No, you need to use this design pattern here and design pattern there. And, you know, I always kind of thought, well, you know, we managed to solve business problems and, you know, write code in VB that, you know, solved problems, and we didn't have to use any patterns. But it's, you know, it's always kind of, you know, you talked about the provider pattern, which is really just the combination of two other patterns and a rebranding. you know, these things have been around forever, and they're, you know, it's not that they're in vogue or they're in fashion now. It's that we can finally do them in a Microsoft IDE.
I agree and I disagree with that, some of that. I mean, I do think that, you know, I totally agree that, you know, none of these quote-unquote alt.net concepts are, you know, the alt.net community didn't invent these concepts. But I do think that they've sort of helped raise the awareness of them in the .NET community, a lot of whom came from the VB background and therefore didn't have, you know, a solid base in a lot of the concepts. I do also feel like, you know, for me personally, for a long time, you know, I looked to Microsoft as, you know, a sort of a model for how development should be done. And I feel like my consciousness has been raised in a lot of ways some of the concepts that I've been reading about. And a lot of that has to do with the people that are involved in the community. So, you know, I certainly feel like I've learned a lot from, you know, people like Allende and Larrabee, and it's definitely sort of opened my eyes to some things that I think I was sort of myopic about in the past, because, you know, I was used to sort of the Microsoft way of doing things, and hey, Microsoft was the most successful software company ever, so you would think that, you know, their way of doing things would be a good way of doing things, but that, obviously that isn't always the case. So I definitely appreciate what that community has brought to my own understanding of development.
I think what you're bringing up there with Microsoft being a successful development company is true, and also has thrown me and other people off, which is Microsoft has been successful at shipping certain types of software and not successful about shipping other types of software. And, like, you have to look at Microsoft as, you know, they produce
an operating system, frameworks, and certain applications that are very, you know, specific and monolithic, like, you know, they produce Office, they produce some pretty heavy systems, and are not generally known for being agile. So I think that, you know, you look at Microsoft and you have to say, well, what did they do well? And based on what I know about them, those are the things that I'm going to bring into my expectations, you know, like if they bring out a pattern, if they bring out a system that does so-and-so, if they haven't done that with input from a lot of customers, then it's, you know, maybe it's going to work, maybe it's not. It depends all on how well the developer figured out their user base. And I think that applies to a lot of other things too, where you just have to, you build up this skepticism where you say, okay, what do you got? And then you have to look at it and say, well, that's, what is that based on? Whose problem are you solving? Is that me? And go from there.
Yeah, I mean, in everything that comes out of Microsoft, you have to look through the lens of, you know, their job is to sell software. And often that aligns with my goal, which is to effectively write software. But not always. I mean, it may be that the way that they sell their software is not the way that I want to write my software. So this goes back to the, you know, focusing on creation, because it's easier to sell that to a CIO or a... you know, development director or whatever. But that doesn't necessarily translate into my life being easier in the long run. And so, you know, being aligned with people who are aligned with my goals is part of, you know, identifying the community that you're in.
All right, well, that'll wrap it up for this week. Please join us next week for another exciting edition of Herding Code.
You know, Kevin, your voice is always calm and reassuring, and I kind of wish you were working maybe for the Fed right now, and you could be making press statements.
If I was aligned with the Fed,
you could be the Bush press secretary. You could get up and say, "There's nothing wrong with the economy."
Like the Iraqi whatever,
exactly.
Ministry of Information.
Our borders are secure. It's, you know, it can only go up. It'll either go down and, you know, it'll be the apocalypse and we'll be bartering with furs and stone tools anyway.
Right.
Or it's going to go up.
And at that point, our software development skills not going to be that helpful. Maybe, no, I don't know.
It'll be great. We'll have something to barter with. We can write a database to keep you, you know, help you keep track of your bones and jewelry. Ha ha ha.